Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this last day of a week of reckoning in Iraq. Where do we go from here? 300 military advisors are being asked to do a job that tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers and $12 billion worth of training funds over 11 years couldn't accomplish. Hard realities meet wishful thinking in that ancient city of fables and myths called Baghdad. Also this hour, we'll talk about the urgent matter of unaccompanied minors arriving in the U.S. to be reunited with their immigrant parents and what a nightmare that has become for the state of Arizona. A new film comedy looks at love, abortion, and a complicated and common experience for young women that doesn't get talked about much except by lawmakers and protesters screaming in state legislatures and demonstrations. But we're going to start the program with a man in a very difficult position right now. Lukman Faley, the Iraqi ambassador to the United States, who patiently answered a number of questions yesterday from me about whether his government can survive, he said guardedly yes. Whether his country was falling apart, he said guardedly no, but that the nation is facing an emergency. He responded to the question of what Iraqis have to fight for besides their religious or ethnic identities right now. And he gave an impassioned defense of the Iraqi nation and its democratic institutions, as he called them. What he says, and you'll hear it in a moment, may seem at odds with some of the facts on the ground we've been reporting all week, but here was a diplomat bravely fighting to defend his country with a passion not unlike the government troops trying to hold back the forces of ISIS militants on the ground in Baghdad, Mosul, and Tikrit.
I was voted in through our Iraqi parliament for these positions. I have a clear Iraqi discourse. There is a lot of discussion to do. At this moment, we need to look into what commonalities we have, which is to do with common threat of terrorism, and we need to talk about a political process moving forward, but that's for the political, for our politicians back home to do. I'm just a mere diplomat.
But as a diplomat, you would have no fear of going to Mosul this week?
No, certainly wouldn't.
And to Crete?
No, I wouldn't. These are all Iraq. As far as I know, as far as people tell me, as far as I believe in that, this is all Iraq. By the way, I'm a Kurd and a Shia, so where does that put us?
Well, the question is not for me. The question is for you. If you were to land in Mosul today, would you pull out your Iraqi passport first, or would you say, hey, I'm a Shia, I'm a Kurd, don't hurt me?
No, what I'm saying is we are not having an identity fight here. We're having a fight against terrorism. The ISIL issue is not that they're hijacking the Sunni element or the Sunni identity. We know for a fact that they don't represent Sunnis. When they execute Sunni imams in Mosul because they were unable to hand over the mosque to them, what does that tell you? That they, ISIL, do not believe in anybody but themselves.
When we spoke in the past, you admitted that the invasion of Iraq in 2003 changed Iraq for good. And you spoke very candidly. Some of it was for the better and some of it was for the worse. What's happened in the last 2 weeks in Iraq? Has that changed Iraq for good? And will we ever see the borders that we've known for nearly a century now back to where they were on the maps that you can buy every day?
There is a bigger question as to the narrative of sectarianism and so on within the whole region. And we've seen that crystal clear after the Arab Spring. What we need to do together is talk to each other, all the countries of the region, as to how do we can harmonize the situations so that we can coexist and peacefully work. We have a tumor in our regional body called ISIL and Al-Qaeda and so on. We need to address that. We need the breathing space to reflect more. To do that, we need support now.
Is partition on the table as part of this breathing space?
Certainly not. I'm not aware of anybody talking about it or others. What they are saying is that we need to redefine some of the political issues, and I'm sure the next government will do that. The next parliament will do that. We just recently had elections, fair elections. But to do that, we need to defeat terrorism.
Personally, what scares you the most about what's going on right now? I know you have family back in Iraq.
The biggest threat we have is, for example, if a Shia mosque or other religious sites are damaged, that will certainly make the situation transnational. People in Pakistan and others will watch this and say, what happened to our religious places? What's going on? And so that's what I mean when I talk about transnational. I'm talking about Pakistan, anywhere else in the world where there are Shias, where there are Sunnis, where there are other situations. Iraq has a significant geopolitical influence, culturally, religiously, and others. This is the threat we have.
So just to be clear, if this doesn't go well, it will involve Pakistan, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the entire Gulf, and the entire Muslim world.
Let me be clear. What I'm saying is, if what took place in Samarra before, where the Shia mosque was destroyed, if anything of that type of nature do, or if a massive ethnic cleansing take place, which is the main doctrine of ISIL, then the ramification will go to not just to the immediate neighbors, but it will go global. Bearing in mind that, in addition to that, you have Iraq as an extremely rich country in oil supply to the global world, to the global energy. If that's in threat, that you have a problem as well.
Ambassador Faley, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Lukman Faley is the Iraqi ambassador to the United States. Joining us now is Robin Wright, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Welcome, Robin.
Great to be with you.
So do you think what's going on in Iraq right now was absolutely inevitable almost from the beginning in 2003?
No, I don't. I think that there was actually a turning point in 2006, which was really critical. And it was at that juncture when the United States committed to deploy 30,000 extra troops for a surge. There's a big debate in Washington, as there is today, about what the United States could do to reverse what was then a kind of microcosm of what we're seeing today, and that is a militant Sunni insurgency against the Shiite-led government. And at the time, the Joint Chiefs of Staff said to the Bush administration, we are confident that our military forces can achieve our military goals, but what we're concerned about is whether our diplomatic counterparts can get the Iraqi government to agree to a power-sharing arrangement. And what happened was the Joint Chiefs was right. The military forces actually did achieve their military goal. That did push back the insurgency. Al-Qaeda was pushed basically back into the boonies. But the problem was that we never got that power-sharing agreement. So that's the turning point at which we have seen consistent disintegration of the political process.
And so let's explore that a little bit. In a sense, the awakening, the extent to which David Petraeus and the surge strategy was able to reach some sort of an agreement with the Sunni activists and tribal leaders in Fallujah and the Anbar area of Iraq became the seeds of the undoing of Iraq, in the sense that certain kinds of promises were made that at some point eventually power sharing would take place. Maliki didn't deliver on those promises, and the U.S. didn't back up its talk to the Sunnis with any real action. And so, boom, it explodes.
That's right. And then you also have, obviously, the implosion of Syria next door, which gave fertile ground for ISIS to seize territory, to mobilize additional forces both within Syria and from the outside world, and then to turn around and come back into Iraq. And so you have those two factors that were decisive. I mean, one of Prime Minister Maliki's tragic mistakes was that he did not incorporate the Sunnis who fought in the awakening in 2006 and 2007. That's so pivotal to the military success that allowed the United States actually to leave Iraq.
Which he could have easily done. I mean, he could have easily done that. They were ready to go.
That's right. And Iraq is not a poor country. It had the resources to pay these guys, whether it was paying them off, creating jobs for them, incorporating them into rebuilding forces, bringing them into the various levels of security forces. There were many different options. And to say he has blown it would be the understatement of the year.
One of the most dreary sort of illusions of wisdom of being a member of the media is that, you know, you can look in hindsight at events that seem easy to analyze, you know, after the fact. But I have to say, the Washington Post's headline this morning drives me absolutely crazy. White House beginning to consider conflicts in Syria and Iraq as a single challenge. Beginning? Excuse me? That can't possibly be true, is it?
Well, yes, I think it is. Oh. And to a certain degree. And that is that in the past, for the past 2.5-3 years, we've looked at the Syrian conflict as a military challenge. And how do we primarily help the opposition, strengthen the opposition against Assad so that they are not so easily overwhelmed? What we're beginning to look at is the common political problem. And at the end of the day, the reality is that neither crisis is going to be solved militarily. There's no single military option, no single deployment of forces or air power that will turn it around. Both of them ultimately have to be solved politically. And that's, I think, where what people are now beginning to call the Syriac problem begins.
And, you know, the thing that drives me crazy here is that this was something that was really a reality during the 2003 invasion. And in the first 3 or 4 years after the invasion, there were constant issues of militias crossing the border into Syria or crossing from Iraq into Syria, Syria into Iraq. So they've understood that this border was porous and that one side was helping the other side from really the very beginning. Why this should be a surprise is just beyond me.
Well, and the irony is that the Syrian government actually allowed many of the foreign fighters to go into Iraq, and now it's facing a challenge from some of those same foreign forces. But the borders of the Middle East, many of them are porous or ill-defined or arbitrary, imposed by European powers a century ago. And so what we're seeing, besides the immediate crisis, is some real questioning of whether these borders are viable in the 21st century. Are we getting into a situation where you may have to redraw the map?
All right. So three blunt questions before we go. Is this partition, I've been asking everybody this week, are the 300 military advisors being asked to achieve what $12 billion and 11 years of U.S. involvement in Iraq couldn't achieve in this new initiative from President Obama? And is John Kerry going over to Iraq to basically usher Nouri al-Maliki to the sidelines?
John Kerry clearly is going to send a very tough message to Prime Minister Maliki. And I think from President Obama's language yesterday, it's quite clear that the United States would like to see him go. I think a growing number of Iraqis think that he needs to go, that he has been the problem and can't be part of the solution now. In terms of partition, it's very hard to see how Iraq holds together. The longer this battle goes on, the greater the dangers. And the problem for 300 military men is that they're basically being sent across to be babysitters, to try to get the Iraqi army to do what it's supposed to do, to prevent it from fragmenting as the Iraqis try to protect the capital. But that's not going to reverse the tide of the ISIS sweep across the north. And that's a bigger problem, that once you get the political issue solved, then you begin to deal with the military. But Prime Minister Maliki may make this very difficult. And the longer this goes on, the greater the dangers for Iraq itself.
Always great talking to you, Robin.
Thank you, John.
Robin Wright, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. This week, we've gone from raw numbers to human faces to some very grim pictures of an immigration policy out of control in the United States. More than 1,000 migrant children, part of an influx of tens of thousands of children trying to reunite with their parents in the U.S., have been shipped to a Nogales, Arizona holding center. And it's not the only such holding center dealing with this crisis. Joining me now, Senator Kelly Ward, Republican state senator representing Arizona's 5th District. Welcome, Senator Ward.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on today.
What is your reaction to these pictures and to what's going on in Nogales?
Well, you know, it's really devastating to our state. It's just amazing that the federal government could bring people who have crossed our border illegally and just drop them off within the borders of Arizona. Now, I realize that they're dropping them off at a federal installation. However, I've been told that our governor was not prepared. Our governor was not told that this was going to happen. Nogales wasn't given time to prepare for this large influx of people that they're expected to take care of. And to me, that's just appalling that the United States government would do that and that Arizona didn't have time to come up with an Arizona solution and an Arizona plan to deal with this.
So what you're saying is, in part, it makes your state look bad because it's the federal government who was unprepared. You weren't even told about anything. What do you make of some of the rhetoric saying, hey, these kids shouldn't even have been allowed to come here? They should be shipped back south of the border, or they shouldn't even be handled in this way. There should be some sort of more orderly attempt to send the parents south of the border to be reunited with the children in Mexico.
I'd have to say that I do agree that their embassies and their consulates from those countries, from El Salvador, from Honduras, from Guatemala, that they should be intricately involved in this process. They shouldn't just be brought to the United States and then all of that burden fall upon our taxpayers to pay the bill for the people who are in need or who have services that are necessary. You know, I'm very concerned with having mules and coyotes bringing these people to our border illegally and our federal government completing that human trafficking loop. I think that that is not a good precedent to set. I think that we should be sending a message back to those countries that if you come to the United States, you're not going to be able to stay.
Now, you can't fault a 12-year-old or an 11-year-old or an 8-year-old to try to be reunited with mom and dad, right? I mean, their motives are clear here, right?
Well, I don't think an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old has the wherewithal to say, I live in Guatemala and I'm going to cross across almost a half of a continent to reunite with my parents who illegally entered the United States. There must be adults that are involved in this process. Believe me, I feel for the children. I have compassion for the children. However, allowing this to happen is a horrible precedent for our country that we can't handle. We can't handle this massive influx of illegal people crossing our border.
What would it cost to basically reunite these kids in the Nogales detention center and the other detention centers around the United States, reunite them with their parents wherever they are in the U.S., then deport them back to Guatemala, Honduras, or El Salvador versus just granting them some sort of temporary visa, you know, at the moment that they enter the United States? What would you assess the cost of those two scenarios?
I think that the costs of both are immeasurable. Putting that burden on our governments, our state governments, our federal governments, our local governments, to attempt to find people who came here illegally to reunite them with their children. In the meantime, caring for those children for weeks, days, months, years is also unacceptable to the American taxpayer. The right thing to do is, as these people, all ages, children, adults, pregnant women, young men, old men, as they cross our border, we process them and we send them to their consulate or to their embassy for return to their home country.
What do you think the federal government should do here? I mean, in many ways, people are saying that the fact that the federal government has done nothing is the principal problem. You can have dozens of different policy options here, but it's the doing nothing that creates this crisis. What, if it not hundreds or thousands of faces of kids at a detention center, is going to make this an urgent issue for Congress? I mean, if this doesn't work, what's going to light a fire under the people in Washington? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that what I hear the outcry from my district and throughout the state of Arizona and from around the country as well. The outcry is secure our border and enforce our current laws. That's all the federal government has to do. We don't need, quote, comprehensive immigration reform, unquote. We just need to enforce the current laws on the books and make sure that our border is secure. Once we do that, it's going to send a message to South American, Central American countries, and it will allow people who want to do this process legally and in an orderly manner to do so. I think there probably should be a little bit easier path to be able to come so that if people want to come, it doesn't take 7 to 10 years for them to be able to get to what their ultimate goal is in the United States. That is not, you know, comprehensive immigration reform. That is tweaking our existing laws to make it a little bit easier for people to come here legally. And I think that's what needs to be done.
Do you think crises like these divide America in that the border states have a very different view of the problem than places like Iowa or Minnesota or Missouri or Florida?
I think that everyone is realizing what a problem our lack of enforcement of our immigration laws is, because people are ending up in all states. They're not just in the border states. Of course, we border states are affected more than people who are more in the inner part of the United States. But there are illegal immigrants in Iowa, in Missouri, throughout the country, and it affects the economies in all of those places. And people are fed up. They want the border to be secure and they want our laws to be enforced.
Senator Kelly Ward, Republican State Senator representing Arizona's 5th Senatorial District. Thanks so much, Senator.
Thanks for having me.
Guess what I wear as a hat?
What?
A lentil.
Mom! Shauna Glassman had 5 caterers at her bat mitzvah, and everyone talked about how great that was, so we need 6 caterers.
Boss man, I need to leave early today because my shrink got me and him tickets to a Pitbull concert.
Talented comedian, internet star, and actress Jenny Slate is about to break out in a huge feature film that some have called the Thelma and Louise of abortion. I suppose it makes sense that abortion would be the vehicle for an actress whose stand-up comedy makes heavy use of the V word and who dropped the F-bomb on Saturday Night Live one time. The film Obvious Child is not an A-bomb about abortion. It's a frank, honest, and tender story about an experience that it's estimated that 1 in 3 women will have in their lifetimes. Even though you would never know that from the supercharged political rhetoric surrounding the issue. The story is told through the experience of the main character, Donna. Gillian Robespierre is the writer and director of the film Obvious Child. Gillian and Jenny Slate knew they were onto something from the moment they started reading the script.
We felt the need to tell a story that has been silenced in our culture and in mainstream movies.
I think we would argue that, at least to us, what is important is the complexity of Donna's experience. You know, she makes a clear choice to have the abortion. It's matter of fact. She's just going to get it. She wants it, and she's not ready to be a parent in any way. But what was interesting to me when I read the script is that I haven't seen this kind of complex experience play out yet where a woman makes a clear choice, but that doesn't mean that she's perfect in any way. I mean, Donna's really, really trips her way through this, and she manages to make a lot of sweet connections and good choices, but it's really imperfect, and I like that.
Here's a clip from The Obvious Child.
Maybe you want to tell him.
No, why? Why? You don't owe him anything. You don't even know this guy.
Maybe he just deserves to know that, like, this happened, that I'm not a psycho, and I'm going to get an abortion.
A very natural conversation.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you've had conversations like that in your own lives.
Yeah, I think I've had conversations with friends that are very open, and that we've created this bond of unconditional love where you can tell your friends the deepest, darkest secrets or anything inane, and they won't judge you, but they won't let you get away with it either. If you cross the line and say something that's really hurtful to yourself or to them, they'll sort of step in and say and call you out on it. And that's the sort of relationships we wanted to create in Obvious Child.
And also the situation that I know for sure I went through, especially in my late 20s, which is you're constantly asking the people that guard you and love you but also have to be with you in public if you are a psycho or if you are, you know, an a-hole. Like, just testing out on other people if your decisions make sense. In your gut, they feel right, but everything seems very extreme. Maybe you are gross.
So this group of wonderful people has convinced you you're not a psycho. Should we trust these people?
We'll call them right now.
Yeah, we'll call them right now. Let's find out.
Let's call my husband and, you know, just ask him if I'm a psycho. That's not psycho, right?
No.
To call my husband and ask him if I'm psycho?
No, you can call your husband right now and ask him. Absolutely. Did you worry that the audience would root for this relationship, which is really not supposed to have, you know, legs necessarily?
I want them to root for the relationship, just not for a parenthood that doesn't make sense.
I get a sense that the agony that you see in movies like Juno and Knocked Up feels a little fake to you, even though you might enjoy those movies.
I definitely enjoy those movies, and I don't think they're fake, because I think, you know, there's millions of narratives that could play out, and there's so many different voices, and those voices are really, you know, distinct, funny voices too. Mm. It's just a different story.
Did you know how you were going to film the abortion scene itself? Because, you know, there are so many different ways and places that this can happen. And, you know, you could have done it ER, you know, you could have done it doctor's office.
I mean, right.
Mm. One of the things I think I really drew from in the moment of just of performing that scene is that the doctor's office can be scary. You know, anything that is just going to do anything to your
body. I don't like
the
dentist.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I have a terrible time at the dentist. I don't like them. And I feel like Donna, yeah, she really needs to get this procedure. She does not have any confusion about that. But when she gets into that room, she has two tears. I didn't want her to be, you know, crying on the table. That is not what we're about. And that's not what Donna's story is. But I think in that moment, before the doctor comes in, she's the only being in there. Everything else is a machine. Everything else is something that has no agency. She's the one thing. And that singularity is at once really heartbreaking and
scary.
And scary and also really strong. You know, I think in that moment, she kind of has never felt like a clearer person.
You know, one of the challenges of this movie and one of the really interesting experiences about how this movie will be received is that you cannot predict, you know, I mean, in some ways, it's almost impossible to imagine. I mean, certain people will decide up front, I'm not going to see this movie because politically, no way. Mm-hmm. You know, I know what they're after and I'm not going there. But for audiences that will see this movie, you can't predict who is going to be sitting in that audience saying, oh, that's an abortion. And another person who's going to be sitting in the audience and saying, oh, that's the end of some life kind of thing.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
I think that it's not clear in most people's minds what side they're on. I think there's a lot of gray area in our lives and also in the pro and anti-choice movements. And what I like about where we are now in this gray area that and the story we're trying to tell is we're just telling a human story and we're just humanizing an experience. And it's not really about pro-choice or anti-choice or the bitterness that those two sides have with each other. This is actually just one woman's story. And I think if you're in the gray area, you're going to really connect to this story because it's not political.
I think that's why there is not actually any uneasiness in the audience when the film ends, because Donna doesn't have to carry the weight of one movement or both movements on her shoulders. All she has to do is do what is right for her. And I think the fact that it's just Donna and you just see what road she's going to go down. And that's all that we're saying. There's no, like, fingers wagging or any proclamations or agendas. I think it feels good at the end to just see a story that is one story. That's it.
Jenny Slate and Gillian Robespierre, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Jenny Slate stars in The Obvious Child, and Gillian Robespierre is the writer and director of the film. Obvious Child goes into wide release today. All week, as we've been talking about Iraq, we've been asking you to join the discussion. Is this the end of Iraq?
This is Marion from Southern Pines, North Carolina. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates stated that any U.S. president that sent combat troops back to the Middle East in the future would be, quote, nuts, unquote. I totally support the president with his plan. It's got to be up to the Iraqi people to determine how they want to live.
An Iraqi American knows how he would like to see the U.S. proceed.
This is Mohammed from Orlando, Florida, originally from Iraq. Americans should know they don't have to ignore this matter, really. If it's not stepping into the conflict with a mass troops on the ground, they should at least stabilize the situation.
I'd love to know your thoughts at 877-8MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. If you want to catch up on this week's conversations on Iraq or listen back to any stories from the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening and have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. I'll see you from Dallas on Monday. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.